Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And, Jim, we start with the good. We knew this was coming. He's one of the last really viable candidates, probably, to get into this race. It's Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker officially announcing today he's a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. This is a guy who's obviously been on conservatives' radar for a long time, ever since his big-time battle with the unions back as soon as he took office in 2011. And he won those battles against the left, which is one of the reasons why the right loves him. So he gets in at an interesting time in this race, and I think a lot of people on the right are really excited about this.
Some people might speculate that he waited a little too long. I, for one, will enjoy referring to presidential candidate Scott Walker instead of potential presidential candidate Scott Walker, who has formed a super PAC but has not yet confirmed that he's running, even though we've kind of known for a while that it was pretty clear he was going to run. I think that there's a real need for a figure like this in the party right now, and this kind of ties pretty well into our bad martini coming in a few moments, that a lot of Republicans, at least for a long while, said that Scott Walker was kind of in that sweet spot, that this was an indisputably conservative guy. You look at his record. You look at what he's done in the state of Wisconsin. You might argue that his public sector union reforms are some of the most consequential and far-reaching of any Republican figure in the field this year. The flip side of that is that he is a serious guy. He is not just a rabble-rouser. He doesn't just say conservative things. He goes out and does conservative things. The fascinating thing is that I think because he's just got this Wisconsin Midwestern nice style, that he comes across, whether people are going to characterize him as one of the moderates in the race. I don't think he is ideologically at all. I don't think he is in terms of a record at all. But in terms of his style, just being so mild-mannered and plain-spoken, and some people said he was boring. I think you look at some of his past speeches, I don't think he's boring at all. There's a great potential there. And I think there is you look particularly in the light of the last couple of weeks, there is a real need for a unifying figure in this field, somebody who could be everybody's second choice and palatable to everybody. And he's got a good chance to be that figure.
You look at the checklist of what most conservatives want this year, a guy who can win. And he's won three times in a 4-year span against very vigorous competition. He was practically nationalized in a couple different ways. He took on the left and won. He's from a battleground state that actually leans the opposite way usually from Republicans. So, and he's not a Washington figure, so that definitely helps as well. So on to why it's really good that Scott Walker is in this race is because he's tough, he takes on tough issues and wins. And right now, a lot of people continue to flock to Donald Trump based on the crowds that he drew in Las Vegas and Phoenix over the weekend because they see him as a tough talker. And a lot of other people see him as a blowhard who will say whatever it takes to get attention and get higher and higher in the polls. But the problem is that it's really setting off already, months and months before the first votes are actually counted, Jim, a major fight within the Republican Party about Trump, about the right way to take on the issue of immigration. And right now, these battle lines seem to be really, really intense. And while there's a lot of time to mend the fences eventually, this is not the way you really want to start out the campaign.
We've kind of talked about Trump over the last couple of weeks. I think my colleague Kevin Williamson really poured gasoline onto the fire.
Yes.
As only he can. And by the way, I say this agreeing with him and with a great deal of affection for Kevin. I agree with the great majority of what he wrote. I'm just going to observe, Kevin Williamson is not a guy who pulls a punch at all. If Trump fans feel like he was really rough on them, they should see what he does to people who use their cell phones in the theater in light of his notorious Batman-like vigilante campaign against those folks. I kind of feel like we're reaching a point where this dispute over Trump maybe kind of, you don't know when you're going to actually see permanent lasting damage. There are still some Republicans who will cite the Senate race in Mississippi right now. There are still some who will cite the Bevin race against McConnell. The interesting thing is, where did the big fights between kind of your Tea Party, grassroots conservative types, and the quote-unquote establishment? One of the things that's really interesting is that how the Trump, not Trump as a figure, really scrambles some of those, because this is not a guy who's been a grassroots conservative by any stretch of the imagination. And the moment you say finally Donald Trump has taken it to those millionaire elites that run the party, Donald Trump's not a millionaire elite. There's been kind of this fascinating spat that has just kind of gotten worse and worse. And I think, I don't want to speak on behalf of my colleagues, but it's fascinating to watch Trump criticize Jonah Goldberg, my colleague, or Charles Krauthammer, or anybody else, and grassroots conservatives applauding this
contending that somehow Donald Trump is now the new measuring stick for what a real conservative is. And one of the things I you know, to the points I made last week and kind of sticking in my craw is this sense that for a long time, the argument was we didn't want somebody who was a Johnny-come-lately to conservative causes, that we wanted somebody who was a consistent conservative. It didn't count if you suddenly, you know, decided you were conservative right before you needed our votes. Well, Donald Trump pretty much defines that, and we're seeing, you know, a significant chunk of the primary electorate jumping on board the bandwagon. And I think there's a lot of folks who look at this and just kind of see the other side as being gullible. And the flip side is the Trump fans look at us critics and think we're ludicrously closed-minded and taking it personal, and we're not serious enough about the issue of immigration, and we're ignoring their anger, I suppose you could say. I kind of wonder, at some point, does this start becoming permanent damage to the party, or if not permanent, then lingering damage? And that's why it'd be nice to see a big unifying figure in the party come along, and I guess we'll see if Walker is that guy.
And the pages of National Review, National Review Online, have had a lot of different perspectives on this. One that I saw that I thought was interesting and kind of talked about what we have been talking about the last couple of weeks with respect to this story. It was from William Jacobson from Legal Insurrection. And he says, you know, he didn't really get into the Trump factor, but he says the reason people are angry is because this is a really polarizing issue, and that needs to be addressed. Trump could be a fatally flawed messenger, and I think you and I would both agree that he is in this case, but the issue needs to be addressed in a clear and aggressive way, and a lot of people don't see that happening. But obviously there's 16 other people who have a chance to really make that case in a strong way. The problem is, as long as Trump's out there, there's not a lot of oxygen for those other people. But that, I think, is the sweet spot here. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I guess two things that kind of drive me crazy. One of the people say, oh, you know, Trump is the only person in this race who's talking about immigration. If you really are saying that, you just haven't paid attention, right? I mean, you know, you can say, well, I don't like Rubio's plan or something. You can say, you know, Walker is not only talking about, you know, obviously making efforts to restrict illegal immigration. He's actually talking about reducing the rate of legal immigration, echoing Jeff Sessions on that. Perry's put forth a plan years ago trying to take care of sanctuary cities. Those of us who are Trump skeptics look at this and say, okay, it's not that Trump is the only one talking about this. He's the only one talking about it the way you want him to, which is to say angrily and loudly and sneeringly. And oh, by the way, I think in a way when he implies that, you know, Mexicans are rapists, and I think in a damaging way. I think you could make the point about rates of illegal, you know, crime on the border and criminals coming across the border in a way that is, you know, without appearing to imply that, you know, all Mexican illegal immigrants are the worst of humanity. And I think that, you know, he got hyperbolic and out of control on that. And because he seems to be genetically incapable of ever saying, I'm sorry, I misspoke, I went too far. He's got to stand his ground on this because that's the Trump style. And, you know, once again, we find ourselves as a party getting tied into the, you know, what do you think of Donald Trump argument instead of the what should we do about the border and what should we do about illegal immigrant argument.
Exactly. And that's probably an indictment on the media as well, because they just follow the shiny object. And in this case, it's super easy for them to follow it because Donald Trump says outlandish things all the time. So on to the crazy martini now. And this is courtesy of Politico, but with plenty of analysis in today's Morning Jolt from Jim. Hillary Clinton has chosen the overarching economic theme of her presidential campaign, America's middle class needs a raise. In a speech Monday at the famously progressive New School in Lower Manhattan, Clinton will lay out her economic theory of the case, and her main theory is that the incomes of everyday Americans have remained too low for too long. Later on, it says, Clinton's aide said she will discuss some of the structural forces conspiring against sustainable wage growth, such as globalization, automation, and even consumer-friendly sharing economy firms like Uber and Airbnb that are creating new relationships between management and labor. She will argue that policy choices have contributed to the problem and that she can fix it. So, Jim, I didn't realize that Bernie Sanders was already flustering her so much that she's decided to declare war on Uber and Airbnb.
Yeah. By the way, as we speak, Greg, she's giving this address on the economy, and she has already called Scott Walker mean-spirited, saying that if we want to build a better economy, we need stronger unions. Take a look at Detroit and be kind of doubtful of all that stuff. Also, this is about the looking to the future. So far, Greg, she has called for comprehensive immigration reform, the Buffett rule, and tax hikes. So it's a very different agenda than you're used to seeing from a Democratic candidate. No, it's exactly the same one. So, but just on the angle of Uber and Airbnb, whether you like them or not, I thought it was Rehan Salam had a really kind of fascinating article towards the end of 2014, but he saw the liberal criticism against Uber coming along, and they described it as this very exploitative institution that was, you know, somehow unfairly exploiting the drivers for it. It's not like Uber's grabbing people by gunpoint and making them drive cars for them. He doesn't quite understand this explanation of them being exploitative. He says, actually, most of the Uber drivers he's encountered, and I share this experience, they all seem pretty happy with what they do. They, you know, keep their cars very clean. It's a better experience than you're used to getting from taxi cabs. One of the reasons taxi cabs were not so great in a lot of cities, including Washington, D.C., was that there was effectively a cartel. The government only allowed certain companies to operate. The government only allowed a certain number of medallions to be out there. And as a result of that, cabbies kind of had a monopoly. Along comes Uber, and it disrupts the monopoly. And, you know, most users of Uber are pretty darn happy with it. And for all the Uber drivers who aren't happy, well, there's lots of other things you can do. But keep in mind, this is a job where you set your own hours. You just kind of decide, boop, turn it on. You use your own car. It's not like you can't use your car during the off hours. And there's kind of a certain strange antagonism to this. If you know, Hillary's whole speech is about how it's, you know, turning to an economy of the future, but it appears to be doing her best to go back to an economy of the past and stop all the innovations that make up the modern economy. She's building a bridge to the 20th century, Greg.
It's so interesting. Her husband ran as this moderate in 1992. He certainly didn't lead as one in the first 2 years of his administration. Then when Republicans came in, he lurched back to the center to get reelected. She kind of ran as a go back to Bill Clinton in 2008. She is doing the exact opposite this time because the party's just drifted so far.
Yeah, I mean, two interesting things. One is that you look back to the boom of the 90s, and there was wage growth during the 90s. And why were wages going up? Because the economy as a whole was booming. Some of it was kind of the froth of the dot-com bubble and not really built a serious lasting growth. But by and large, the economy did grow in a genuine, somewhat sustainable way for that. You can attribute it to NAFTA. You can attribute it to bouncing back from that oh so terrible recession of the early 90s during the late Bush years when unemployment went all the way up to 6%, Greg. Ah, the deprivation. And the idea that basically why were the average American doing better? Because the whole economy was doing better. Well, now there seems to be a rejection of that on the part of the Hillary types. The average Republican would say a rising tide lifts all boats. If the whole economy is doing well, there's a lot more job creation. There's a lot more competition for workers. You can get a higher rate. You can get a raise because your employer wants to keep you, or you can jump to another job that will pay better. Democrats have really lost faith in that concept. They really believe that the only way that you can get a raise is by government coming in and making you get a raise, whether it's by raising the minimum wage or Hillary's now talking about forcing profit sharing on companies. Boy, what does that sound like? You know, I'm sure she'll make it fair. In addition, she wants to do a huge amount of new infrastructure spending, Greg, and a lot of investment in alternative energy because we haven't seen this movie before. Right. She's talking about this great company called Solyndra. Sounds great. And remember, it's all about ideas for the future. Like, it's not about returning to the past.
There's such an opportunity for the Republican nominee to get the younger generation here. She's so overhung on all this advanced technology that these people just love. Uber, Airbnb, all this stuff, cutting edge stuff. And she still can't figure out a fax machine, as we learned.
You beat me to the punchline, Greg. I just saw from Phil Kirpin. He said, it's not really surprising that older woman who battles her fax machine finds Uber strange and frightening. Also, once again, let me just observe, this is a woman who has not driven since, I think, the early 90s.
Right.
So everything, like all these issues are theoretical to her. She never encounters any of this stuff other than the fax machine that doesn't work. So I suppose we should be pleased her economic proposal doesn't involve easy use fax machine subsidies. It's a great start to the week, Greg.
It sure is. It sure is. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
Tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.